Melvin Bragg with In Our Time.
Hello. The second law of thermodynamics can be simply stated thus. Energy spontaneously tends to flow from being concentrated in one place to becoming diffused and spread out. It was first formulated to explain how a steam engine worked. It can explain why a cup of tea goes cold if you don't drink it, and how a pan of water can be heated to boil an egg. But its application has been found to be rather grander than this. The second law is now used to explain the Big Bang, the expansion of the cosmos, and even suggests our inexorable passage through time towards the heat death of the universe. It's been called the most fundamental law in all of science. And C.P. Snow in his Two Cultures wrote, "Not knowing the second law of thermodynamics is like never having read a work of Shakespeare." So what is the second law? What are its implications for time and energy in the universe? And does it appear to be refuted by the existence of life and the theory of evolution? With me to discuss the second law of thermodynamics is John Gribbin, visiting fellow in astronomy at the University of Sussex and author of Deep Simplicity, Peter Atkins, professor of chemistry at Oxford University and author of Galileo's Finger, and Monica Grady, head of meteorites at the Natural History Museum. John Gribbin, before we go into detail of the second law, can you give us an indication of how a law which began concerning steam locomotives came to have such a broad application? Can you give us an overview?
Well, it's because, as you said, it deals with heat. It deals with the flow of heat from one place to another. That's one manifestation of the second law. And, of course, that was hugely important in the 19th century as Britain, in particular, industrialised and the rest of the world followed suit. If you could understand how heat worked, you could build more efficient steam engines, putting it very simply, and so your industry would be more efficient. But it goes hand in hand with developing technology. As you learn to develop better technology and better steam engines, then you learn more about the second law as well. So these things always in science sort of go hand in hand in a ratcheting process. And it goes back even a bit further than that to earlier in the 19th century. There was a guy called Count Rumford who started life as Benjamin Thompson. And he was involved in boring cannon to make cannon for warfare. And he realised that the process of boring out the cannon generated heat in an inexhaustible fashion, which is the important thing. Before then, people had had the idea that heat was a kind of a fluid called caloric, which was existed in something. And if you heated it by friction, you'd rub it all out and it'd all be used up. And he discovered that no matter how long you kept grinding away at the lumps of iron to make cannon, you kept producing heat. So there's this realization that heat was a form of energy. It became understood as a form of energy. And energy, of course, is what drives the whole universe and keeps us going. So it's absolutely fundamental.
Two things there before we move on. One is that the link between, in Britain, between the industrial development of the Industrial Revolution, between practicality, practical technology, how do we get this engine to work properly, and theory is fascinating. They seem to go, they don't often go as closely hand in hand as that. And secondly, the realisation that this was actually also not only about how the steam engine worked, but also about the origins of change in everything.
That's the important thing, but there's a curious thing about this, is that although it's called the second law of thermodynamics, and it's got the dynamics built into it, the way people got at it was actually by looking at systems that are not changing, systems in equilibrium, as it's called, that you cannot deal very easily with systems where there's a lot going on, where the energy is being generated in one place and dissipated, turned into work, doing something else. You have to pretend at each stage that you're dealing with a system which is in equilibrium. So you consider things like a box of gas, a boiler full of steam it might be, and you work out how that affects the pressure of the steam and so on. And then you consider a different situation where there's a cooler temperature and a different pressure and so on, but you don't actually understand properly how you get from one stage to the other. And that's something that's become very important 100 years later and is now causing revived interest in what thermodynamics is all about.
Can you tell us, just because the listeners will be clamouring to hear this as I am, what's the first law of thermodynamics?
Right, well, the first law is very simple. It's a kind of sort of throat clearing, which says that the total amount of energy in the universe always stays the same. And it's been paraphrased as saying you can't get something for nothing. And the second law, in a similar vein, has been paraphrased as saying things wear out. And so you're always losing useful energy. And what matters is that although the total amount of energy in the universe stays the same, you can only do work, as in a steam engine, by moving energy from a hot place to a cold place. And as you do so, some heat gets lost in the process. That's the second law at work. And eventually, as this goes on and on and on, the whole universe will end up at the same temperature. And if everything's the same temperature, you can't do anything useful. You can't run a steam engine in which both bits of the steam engine are at the same temperature. And so this is the idea that things will eventually wear out entirely. And that ties in with what you were talking about, the arrow of time. There's a past when things are lively and interesting and heat flows from one place to another, and a future where everything's cold and dark and worn out.
Throughout this first part of the programme, we're going to use the steam engine as a metaphor for big bangs, for all sorts of change, which we'll come on to. Peter Atkins, can you introduce us, can we go further into the steam engine and tell us what the... how the theory grew out of the practice? Because that's one of the fascinating things. Is these men are working away, making this thing to go along railway lines, and the theory develops alongside or around it. Can you tell us how, say, the French physicist Sadi Carnot, what he did about it?
Yeah, I think there are really four people who constructed the second law. One is Sadi Carnot. Another was William Thomson, Lord Kelvin, later. And then there was Rudolf Clausius, and finally there was Ludwig Boltzmann, and each made a very special contribution to understanding. Carnot looked at a steam engine and tried to identify what was the limits of its efficiency. Everyone thought at the time that, you know, England was producing its munitions, it was pumping its wells and so on, pumping its mines with steam. And the French were terrified, so there was a huge interest in France on making their machines more efficient. And Carnot looked at the structure of a steam engine and tried to think what it was that determined its ultimate efficiency. Most people at the time thought that it might be changing the pressure, might be changing the working substance from, say, steam to air and so on. But Carnot came up with what turned out to be an absurd idea in the views of his contemporaries, that it was only the temperature. That, as John just mentioned, a steam engine really consists of three bits. There's the hot reservoir. There's the cold sink, where you throw away some heat. And there's the gubbins in between, really, the piston, which converts heat into work. And Carnot, by thinking about the machine, decided that it was only the temperature of the hot source and the temperature of the cold sink that determined its ultimate efficiency, regardless of anything else. And this was really a deep insight into the nature of the conversion of heat into work. It really meant that to get the greatest efficiency for a steam engine, you had to use a reservoir that was as hot as possible, and a cold sink that was as cold as possible.
The sink being, in this case, just the engine itself.
The rest of the world.
The rest, yeah.
If you like.
Yeah. What were the chief modifications that the other, or extensions that the other three that you mentioned gave to it?
Well, Carnot's views were seen to be so absurd that they were ignored, which I suppose for England was a good thing. But then his book sort of survived in print, and Kelvin came across it and started to think about it in more detail. And he came up with the view that really the most important part of a steam engine was not the hot bit, it was not the piston, it was the cold bit. And he said effectively, and this is yet another statement of the second law of thermodynamics, that steam engines don't work unless you've got the cold sink. The next person to come along was Rudolf Clausius, and he said something that we all know anyway, that heat doesn't flow from a cold object to a hot object. I suppose one of my favourite sayings in science was from the Hungarian biochemist St. George, who said that science is about seeing what everyone else has seen, but thinking what no one else has thought. And everyone had seen that heat doesn't flow from cold to hot, but no one had thought about it. Clausius did think about it, and he formulated it his ideas quantitatively in terms of entropy and so on, and we'll come on to entropy shortly, I suppose.
And finally, can briefly, you've got the other one to go. Yet another man whose ideas were dismissed as completely absurd.
Boltzmann, I suppose, was short-sighted physically, but he saw more into the nature of the world than anyone else. And he identified the molecular basis of the second law, that why it is that what we have been saying is true in terms of the behaviour of individual atoms and molecules. And that's, which we'll come on to, I think is a major revelation about why the world works in the way that it does.
Monica Grady, Kelvin and Lord Kelvin understood that you had to let some heat escape if other heat was to use to power the turbines. In other words, some heat had to be jettisoned. Now, where does this fit in? I mean, we've got two very powerful introductions from John and from Peter. Where do we go next, then, to sort of build up the theory alongside the steam engine?
Well, we have to look at where the heat's going to and what this system is. John referred to equilibrium, and you tend to get equilibrium in a closed system, and of course in a closed system you won't get this work happening.
Can you just tell the listeners what you mean by a closed system?
Oh, a system where nothing can escape.
Like a sealed box.
Sealed box. A sealed box is a closed system. You're not putting heat in, you're not putting allowing any heat to escape. You have a closed system. Now, in a system like that, you're not going to be able to do any work because you're not going to get a change. You're not going to allow heat to escape. And so the big thing about the steam engine, as Peter Atkins referred to, is this cold sink. And there isn't a big sort of heat absorber in a steam engine. The cold sink is the outer universe, and the Victorians tended to look at things because they didn't understand the universe, had got no concept of how enormous the universe was. They looked at things on a much smaller scale. But now we realise that actually when we're looking just at a simple steam engine on a railway in Britain, it's putting heat out into the atmosphere, which is, you know, travelling around the globe, which then has implications within the solar system, within the galaxy and so on. So the whole system is the universe, and that is where the heat is gradually dissipating to. So we must look bigger than just the simple cold system.
The word that comes in now, there's one word that is disorder. Things go from order to disorder. Mm-hmm. From the closed system of order, one can say, to outside, the heat is more disordered than the liquid. The liquid is more disordered than the solid. Mm-hmm. So order to disorder is the progression. And then the word entropy comes in.
Right.
So would you just explain why it came in and what it means, what its usefulness is in this discussion?
Well, entropy is a measure of the amount of disorder in a system, and if you think of a solid crystal, that's a very, very ordered system. You have atoms, you have ions, perhaps vibrating in a lattice, but it's quite rigid. If you then melt or dissolve that solid, you have liquid where you have molecules, atoms are able to move around much more swiftly in a much more disordered way. And then think of converting that into a gas, which would fill a whole room. Think of an ice cube going to a puddle of water, going to steam. You have something that would then fill the whole room. You can't then predict where that molecule is, which molecule is going to hit a wall. The whole thing becomes more disordered as you heat it up, and you can't go back again in a predictable fashion. You can't say, I'm going to take that molecule and put it there. And this is where John referred to time's arrow. This is where time's arrow comes in, as we have this increase in disorder, this increase in entropy in the universe. It seems to be always pointing in one direction. We can't reverse entropy. We can't decrease entropy on this universal scale.
So in that explanation, we're always losing energy, and we're always moving towards disorder, and we're always moving towards more heat.
We're not losing energy, we're just sort of changing the form of energy, if you like, or
we're
spreading...
We're losing useful energy, I should say. Useful energy, yeah.
We're spreading it all out, we're making it more even. We're going from, say, to use a water analogy, we're going from a waterfall, where you've got water going from a high point to a low point. We're going more to an ocean, where everything is spread out at the same level.
So just to summarise this section before we move on, John Grubin, back to you. Okay, the steam, we've got the steam engine, and very briefly, what theory comes out of the steam engine that then drives through in the 20th and the 21st century?
Well, it is this business that you can sum up as saying that things wear out. You have this idea that you do not have an eternal reservoir of energy, that the universe is going to wear out. And there was a lot of discussion about what was called the heat death of the universe at this time. And it comes back to the arrow of time. And that's really was the driving force for people to understand why we live in a universe where there is a direction of time, where in a sense there was a beginning and there will be an end, and how we're getting from one to the other. And then later on in the 20th century, why should we be around? We complicated beings living on the face of a planet where lots of interesting things are happening, why should we be around at a particular time to be able to notice all this? So it struck very fundamentally at our basic ideas about the meaning of life, if you like.
But from this industrial object came these theories which that now underlie notions as to how the whole thing operates. Peter Atkins talking, what's happening to the universe at large then when these heat, how do we transfer the steam engine, as it were, to the universe at large? With this theory.
Well, I mean, the briefest statement of the second law, which I think we ought to focus on, is that things get worse. If you like, energy has both quantity and quality, and entropy is a measure of the quality of energy. And so as entropy increases, that is, as the world becomes more disorganized, so the quality of energy degrades. But the crucial point is that although energy may disperse, you can tap into that dispersal and use it constructively. So if you think of the engine in a car, the fuel is burning, and the energy that is released in that way spreads, and also the carbon dioxide and water that is produced when the fuel burns also disperses. But your engine is a way of tapping into that dispersal, and you use it to drive pistons and so on, and then you can connect those pistons through gears to bricks which you build into a cathedral and so on. So you can use this dispersal constructively, and that's the crucial idea. And you can transform the same idea to, for example, when you eat in the morning, the food that you ingest undergoes metabolism and so on. It breaks down, it releases energy. Think of it as fuel once again. And instead of having a mechanical train of pistons and gears like in a car, what you've got is a biochemical train of gears and so on, which can be used to, not in this case, to put one brick upon another to build a cathedral, but to put one amino acid next to another to build a protein. And you can be, so in other words, as you eat and disperse energy, so you grow, and the processes of life continue. And you can be even more fanciful, if you like, that if you think of the random electrical currents in your brain becoming organized by the same kind of process in order to, you eat, and through the biochemical processes that occur and drive the neurophysical processes in your brain, you think. And so an act of creation, like writing a piece of poetry, giving this talk, an act of gallantry and so on, are all ultimately driven by the dispersal of energy. And that is why it is so far-reaching.
Both those examples, of course, that ultimately depend on energy from the sun. The fuel we use in the car has come from stored-up sunlight in plant remains, and the food is ultimately from stored-up sunlight in plants. And what's happening is that we've got a negative entropy happening locally because the sun is making positive entropy on a much larger scale.
I want Monica to unravel that a bit. A negative entropy happening locally. Can you just describe how the sun works in our system and prevents our own planet from being a closed system, and therefore just stay with our planet and the sun at the moment, and therefore has the effects it has on the entropy here. Could you just take that on a bit?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, if you look at life and this building up of life, you might think, well, that is something that's becoming more complex. But when we look at a larger system, like the system which incorporates the sun, then we see what's actually happening is the sun is this enormous ball of hydrogen, and the hydrogen is fusing together to become atoms of helium. And as it does that, it gives out heat and light. And that heat and light bathes the Earth. It powers our atmosphere, our climate, our weather. It powers the carbon cycle, the water cycle. It powers the whole of life on Earth, from the simplest of organisms right to us. If you think of a food chain that always starts with grass, some photosynthetic organism, which depends on sunlight. And so you need the engine that's the sun. And so you've got this very hot object producing heat, and if you like, we are the cold sink in that system of the sun Earth. You've got the hot object, you've got the cold object, and in between you've got this enormous biosphere which is doing the work as you've got that transfer. And you've also got heat dissipating, you've got energy dissipating, because obviously not all comes to the Earth or within the solar system.
So let's move a bit further out now, John Gribbin, and go to the Big Bang, where presumably if disorder is coming from order, then we can look for a point where there was only order, and we inevitably go back to the Big Bang. Is that right?
No, that's wrong. It's a big puzzle. It was a big puzzle until quite recently. The Big Bang, the birth of the universe, seems to have been a very disordered state, and we now know this from looking at the famous background radiation, the microwave background radiation, which gives us a picture of what the universe was like when it was only a few hundred thousand years old, a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, at about 13 billion years ago. The universe was very smooth and well distributed, and it was a fairly uniform sea of hot gas. Now, what's happened to the heat is that heat has degraded and it's cooled down to become the very cool background radiation. But what's happened to the matter is that it's been turned into stars and galaxies by gravity. And you have actually made a much more structured system out of a disordered system thanks to gravity. And gravity has a remarkable property which wasn't properly appreciated until relatively recently, is that it runs this whole process backwards. It can make entropy run backwards and create order where there wasn't order before.
Yeah, well, that's a bit... you've gone too fast for me. You really have. It's fine. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do, but I'm supposed to try to keep up. So the Big Bang, which I, in my notes, said that was where we could regard that as the point. You said a few thousand, 100,000 years after the Big Bang. The Big Bang itself came out of disorder, you think? It wasn't an ordered state. So if it came out of disorder, how did disorder go into order? And why was the main rule of the universe now disorder out of order?
What happens is that gravity stores negative energy, I mean literally negative energy. And one way to think about this is that if you have anything spread out as far as possible, you know, a pile of bricks, and you take each brick off to infinitely far away from every other brick, then there's no energy in that system, because the force between the bricks is 1 over the distance squared, Newton's famous law of gravity, and 1 over infinity squared is 0. So there's no force and there's no energy in that system. If you spread all the atoms in the sun out to an infinite distance, and if they then come together, you all know that if things fall down, they release energy. It's the waterfall that we talked about earlier. If you drop something from a tall building and it hits the ground warms up a little bit, and this energy comes out of gravity as the material collapses to make a star. The star releases energy. The star is generating energy now. It's hot. And this has come from gravity, and literally a gravitational field contains negative energy. And it's quite possible that the entire energy of the universe is zero, that the whole universe, all the matter and energy, adds up to zero because of this negativity of gravity. And that is one possible reason why the universe, or how the universe came into existence in the first place, is that whatever it was that happened in the very beginning, and we certainly don't know. I mean, people have ideas, but we don't know what happened in the beginning.
It does seem quite a simple explanation, actually.
It could have come out of nothing at all, because it may contain literally zero energy, and it's easy to make nothing.
And a lot of that energy is hidden at the moment. I mean, cosmologists call it dark energy or vacuum energy.
Peter Agnes, I want to go back to this. To go back to the second law, to continue with the second law of thermodynamics, as I've been trying to mug it up. John's just thrown a little hand grenade into my thinking there. Should he have done? I mean, how does it obtain with the expansion of the universe? I thought that it explained, that you were saying, it was the spring of the universe, the spring of the origin of change, was the second law of thermodynamics. He's brought in gravity. He said that disorder went to order and then order goes to disorder. Yeah. And I'm a bit confused here, so could you clarify? I'm sure he's right, but can you just clarify it so I understand why he's right?
Well, I wish I could clarify it, but it's one of the great puzzles, I think, about the role of the interaction between gravity and entropy. People still really don't understand it. But I think what we should do is to concentrate on the fairly straightforward attitude that we've got a universe which is originally compact, and that we've got energy that is concentrated, including energy in the form of matter, because matter is really just a form of energy. And when you've got planets that are formed and you've got atoms that are formed, really what you've got is localized energy. And as if you just had a universe that was hanging in space and not expanding, then you could think of this energy and this matter simply dispersing gradually through the available volume and doing all the things that I said before, enabling us to go on living, if you like. But the universe is expanding, so there is always increasing room for this dispersal to occur. And providing the universe goes on expanding forever, there will always be more room for dispersal to occur in. And so events will always continue to occur. You can go on with this program forever, until the end of time, basically. So, really, the key idea, I think, is, first of all, that in the absence of expansion, you can still think of energy and matter dispersing, driving the gear wheels of change, and giving rise to all the events of life. But if the universe is also expanding, then there is no end to that process.
Can you develop the idea, Monica Grady, of the heat death, the universe following an inevitable course towards what will be a heat death of the universe because of the working of the second law of thermodynamics?
Yes, this follows on from what Peter was saying about this constant expansion and the constant flow of energy. As coming back to our star, it converts hydrogen to helium, gives out heat. That helium, the hydrogen will eventually run out. The helium will be converted to carbon, giving out more heat. This is happening in all sorts of stars. Some stars explode, become supernovae, again giving out huge, tremendous amounts of energy. And all those processes within our galaxy, within every galaxy, are leading towards a gradual equalization of the energy within that particular system, and then spreading out between the different galaxies. And each galaxy is not in isolation, it's surrounded by a halo of material that we can't see. It's sort of within a sea of dark matter. So within our whole universe, gradually the stars will build up elements, explode as supernovae, turn those elements back in to the interstellar medium, start new stars forming. It's a constant cycle, but eventually that cycle will run out of hydrogen. All the hydrogen will have been converted into other elements. It's the hydrogen that was formed in the Big Bang. And gradually the whole thing will become dissipated throughout the whole of the universe. And the temperature will gradually have dropped and equalized all over. And we'll go, this is the heat death. By that time, everything is the same temperature all the way through, and no work can be done.
John Gribbin, would you develop that?
Yes, I can't be improved on that picture, but I think I'd like to come back to where it started, what there is to die. if we think about the closed system that we talked about earlier, maybe a box the size of this room, if it was a box the size of this room full of gas, then it would stay in equilibrium and the molecules would bounce around in the way Boltzmann realised, and nothing would change. It would sit there forever in equilibrium. But if that box was the size of our galaxy, then gravity becomes important. And as soon as you get any kind of uneven distribution of the gas in the box, it pulls things together by gravity. And the gravity then makes the order out of disorder by making stars, by gravity pulling things together. And this is why I like to think of the heat death as having happened once and then the universe being revived. In the birth of the universe, in the hot Big Bang, that's the heat that has already dissipated. That's the background radiation, the minus 270 degrees Celsius background radiation. The original universe did die, but while it was dying, there was a kind of a phoenix-like rebirth going on because of this process of gravity, which took the hydrogen, started turning it into energy, making stars, and now we're in the second phase of the life of the universe, and it's going to die again.
Is this speculation, or do you have evidence of this?
That's not speculation. I mean, the evidence is that we're here.
Yeah.
I mean, we're here because there were big clouds of hydrogen gas that collapsed to make stars and planets and people.
Do you have evidence for an earlier heat death?
Well, the background radiation. I mean, we know that the universe was born in a very, very hot state, and that by 300,000 years or so after the birth, it was at a temperature of about 6,000 degrees, the same as the temperature of the sun today, and now it's minus 270 degrees.
Just a second. I'd like to get back, I'll come to you in a moment, Monica, but get back to the idea of the order going to disorder, and get back to try to cold to the second law of thermodynamics. Peter Atkins, in your book Galileo's Finger, you use an example of an astronomical clock in Prague to illustrate the illusion, as you put it, of complexity and the reality of growing disorder. It's a very good, it's a very clean metaphor.
Yes.
To take us on from the steam engine. We go from a steam engine to a clock as we wend our way. But can you just say why you think that illustration is important? And I'll come back to you in a second.
Because you've got a process which is driving a complicated collection of interacting gears, if you like, which give rise, I think, as I say there, to the Acts of the Apostles, as these images move around the clock in Prague. It really summarizes what we've all been saying, that you've got essentially a driving force, which is simply the natural tendency of energy and matter to disperse. In this case, it's the falling of a weight, which disperses its energy through friction and so on. So it's irreversible in the sense that the weight falls, the energy is distributed into the rest of the universe. But there are gears that are driven by this fall, and the gears drive, you know, one apostle out through one door, another apostle out through another door, and they do funny little things and so on. And that really captures what we are. That really captures the basis of the biosphere. In our case, as Monica said, the driving force is the sun. That is the hot source of this solar steam engine. That it gives rise to, it dissipates its energy. But the vegetation on Earth, if you like, provides an analogue of the pistons and the gear wheels of a real steam engine, and drives the processes of growth on Earth. And then we use the vegetation that the sun has driven to drive ourselves. So it's a whole sequence of one object using a particular fuel to create more fuel for another object.
Monica, do you want to add to what John was saying earlier? Because that's something I want to ask you specifically.
Well, I just wanted to ask John about this second or the first heat death of the universe, because of course the background radiation isn't completely homogeneous. It's not 3 kelvins, 2.7 kelvins all the way through, and it's those heterogeneities which have actually caused the galaxies to form, those tiny, tiny little ripples in the background radiation. And so perhaps if a heat death is complete homogeneity, complete isotropy, then we cannot say that actually we have already suffered one heat death. And so I was a bit...
A near-death,
I guess. Yeah, well, close to death.
I'm glad you said that, because I didn't think it was going to happen. All right, now, the business of order to disorder, things becoming more disordered, seems to be contradicted by evolution. One of the things that happens in evolution, lots of different things happen, but one of the things happen is that life becomes more complex, and I suppose our brains are the best example of that, becoming more and more complex. So how is this second law of thermodynamics of things, things getting worse, things becoming wearing out, things more disordered, and we're becoming more... Can Monica answer that? Monica, have a go at that first.
You're still looking at a very small system there,
yeah,
where you're looking at...
It's still part of it. I mean,
we're part of a system. So if we're looking at something becoming more complex in this particular part of the system over here, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not echoed by an increase in disorder somewhere else.
But how does
it's still all being powered by the sun, this increase in complexity.
But how does that sit with the idea of things becoming more disordered, therefore less organised, when a lot of that's happening in evolution is becoming more complex and more organised? Now, your explanation is, but disorder is happening in somewhere else, and by this magic inevitability of equilibrium, the disorder somewhere over there, way over there, with a wave of the hand, is balancing up the increasing complexity and order here. But where is over there,
connected.
And why is complexity happening here?
They're connected. The interesting things happen, what you're calling complexity, interesting things happen where there's a flow of energy. And so you have to be sitting in the flow of energy in order for interesting things to happen, whether it's a waterfall or a human being. Energy is passing through the system. So that energy has to come from somewhere and it has to be connected to you. And in our case, it's coming from the sun. So the increase in entropy produced in the sun is creating the energy flow, which makes us produce a corresponding but smaller change in the opposite direction.
But doesn't it give you any pause that this is contradicting the second law of thermodynamics? That things are not getting worse, that things are not wearing out, that things are not becoming more disordered, things are getting more complicated, and more efficient, more ordered.
We are local abatements of chaos. We are driven into complexity by the creation of greater disorder elsewhere.
But where is this elsewhere you keep saying is going to solve
it? It's on the sun, ultimately. Right. I mean, it's the dissipation of energy on the sun, which is driving events in the vegetation on Earth. Animals eat the vegetation. They use that as fuel. That drives their processes, including their growth, their reproduction, and their thinking, it's like... In a sense, the analogy to keep in mind is if you sat in front of a screen in which there was a weight on the floor and you saw the weight go up, you'd think it was a miracle. But then if you look behind the screen and you see that, in fact, there's a weight behind the screen which is actually falling down and pulling the front weight upwards. So it's when you look at the whole thing that you realise that... there is a simple explanation, that is, energy is dispersing and driving the events which you think are giving rise to complexity. They are, in fact, giving rise to disorder and locally to complexity.
I mean,
it's a neat explanation. I mean, it's very good. You're probably absolutely right. It just seems something getting away with it going on. Monica.
Well, you would say that as a local abatement of complexity, wouldn't you?
Well, I've never been paid such a fulsome compliment in my life.
But if you just consider the solar system, I mean, we are just one planet within the solar system, and the complexity seems to be increasing on our planet, but not on other planets, as far as we're aware. You know, there isn't this increasing complexity, the increasing evolution of a series of life forms on other planets, as far as we know, as far as we can see. So we are just a very, very small neighbourhood.
I can give a much more homely example of this. An ordinary domestic refrigerator. If you've got a domestic refrigerator, it's by a miracle, it's making things colder inside. It's taking heat from a colder place to a hotter place, and it's throwing the heat out the back and getting warm. So it's not violating thermodynamics if you look at the bigger picture. And if you have a sealed room and you open the door of the fridge inside and leave it running, what happens to the room? It doesn't get colder because the cold's coming out of the fridge. It gets hotter because the waste heat from the refrigerator is warming the room, and because no process is 100% efficient, so you're generating more heat outside than you are making cold inside. And that's what we're like. We're like the inside of a refrigerator bathed in the outside that surrounds us in the solar system.
Actually, to be honest, I understood this for the first time properly now when Peter Atkins talked about the sun being the place, but I wanted to sort of... jiggle it along a bit. Einstein said that thermodynamics is the only physical theory of universal content I am convinced will never be overthrown.
Yeah.
Would you go along with that, Peter?
Yeah, I think if you look for the perpetual laws of science, the laws which will persist forever, I think there are very few of them. I think the second law is one such, because I think it is of universal validity. I suspect that one of its manifestations, that is, evolution by natural selection, because that really is just another manifestation of the second law, with the biosphere acting as the pistons and so on of the steam engine, is also universal, and that wherever there is life, there will be natural selection. So, but it's very hard to... And I suspect also that the conservation of energy, really the first law of thermodynamics, is also universal. So today we've been talking about things that will never be wrong.
Really? Can you say that with a straight mind, all of you?
Absolutely.
I believe so. I mean, some of the other laws that we know about, Newton's laws of mechanics, classical mechanics, break down when you look at the atomic scale. So, but I think the laws of thermodynamics are not going to break down when you look on tiny scales, when you look on astronomical scales.
But I would make one proviso. What I said right at the beginning, that they apply, strictly speaking, to equilibrium situations, and the interesting things happen where you don't have equilibrium and you have a flow of energy. So, yes, the second law is an absolute truth as far as it goes, but there's more to thermodynamics than the second law, and that's much more interesting.
We have been talking about our universe as the system, though. I mean, there are suggestions that we are not a simple universe. We are just merely a bubble in a multiverse. Where does that leave us?
Well, I still think that the second law applies within the bubble as well. And I disagree with John by saying that where he says that we've been talking about equilibrium. We've not. We've been talking about the approach to equilibrium, which is quite different. And we organisms are staging posts on the route to equilibrium. We are not equilibrium ourselves. That comes after we're dead and we go back to dust.
Why should that be equilibrium when we go back to dust?
Oh, because the reactions are all over, and you and I are just bags of reactions.
But that seems to me more extinction than equilibrium.
I don't distinguish.
Really? You got away with that one. Really?
Being dead isn't interesting, but how people die is interesting. That's why there are so many murder mystery stories around.
And that's the second law, the interesting bit.
I think we'll stop there, gentlemen and ladies. Thank you very much. Thanks very much, really, to Monica Grady, John Gribbin, and Peter Adkins. Really, thank you very much. That was a difficult for you to compress. Thank you very much for trying so hard to do it. Next week, we're going to talk about the legend of Faust. Thank you for listening.